Good morning. My name is Ben Riga. I'm a technical evangelist with Microsoft, working in a group called Developer and Platform Evangelism. And my focus is exclusively on Windows Phone. First things first, my email address is benriga@microsoft.com. Please take a note of it if you have any questions. Maybe you're too shy to ask questions in the room, although I know the Dutch are not shy. But if you think of questions after the fact, or for whatever reason you're having issues getting your app published, technical issues or other kinds of issues, please let me know. We're trying to do everything we can to make sure your app gets into the marketplace. So anything we can do to help, just let us know. I also am on Twitter. I should say that I'm not making any threats, but if you don't follow me, the puppy dies. So it's at Ben Riga. And I mentioned this earlier. This session was meant to be push notifications, and there actually ended up, because they did some what they call wildcard sessions, I think they called them, one of the local Dutch developers had submitted a session on push notifications, and they selected his session. So then there were two sessions in the catalog on push notifications. So they asked me to change mine. And so I'm going to do one on launchers and choosers, or phone resources. Geert, who is the guy who is doing the push notifications, he's going to be in the Africa room at 1:15 doing his session. In Dutch, also. I think that's what his title says. I can't read that. Okay, so what are we going to talk about? What are launchers and choosers? We'll talk about a lot of different things, some of the stuff that was in the existing Windows Phone 7.0, and then we'll talk about some of the exciting new stuff we added in Mango around adding things like context and calendar or reading context and calendar in the Windows Phone. We'll talk about what launchers and choosers are and when you can use them, and they're all kind of work the same, so we'll use the camera and contacts and some of the others to show you how to use contacts and choosers. We'll also talk very briefly about microphone and how you use that, and the sensors. We'll talk about the motion sensor in particular is probably one of the more exciting ones that we added in Mango. And then finally, we'll talk about video content. So first, let's start with reading contacts and calendars. This is something that's brand new in Windows Phone 7.5. As you can imagine, it's a bit of a sensitive thing because you're actually accessing information directly on a user's device, accessing their contacts and their calendar, which can have personal information that would be private information. And so you have to be very careful in how you use it. And you have to advise the end user how you use it. So you have to be very upfront. That's part of your obligation to the end user to make sure that there's no issues around that. We have seen issues on other platforms where applications have taken users' contact info and uploaded it to servers, sometimes for very legitimate reasons, so they can do matching up social networks and stuff like that. But even when you do it for legitimate reasons, if you don't tell the end user, it gives them a sort of a creepy feeling that they're losing control of their information. So you have to give them the option of allowing you to do that. So please be very careful about that. And of course, doing bad stuff with people's contact information, like spamming their friends and so on, because you have access to it, is completely unacceptable. And we'll get your application bounced. When you do use the contacts and calendars, it is a capability. And so you have to add that as a capability in the application manifest. And so make sure that you do that before you submit to production. Otherwise, it actually won't get accepted in the marketplace. There are a number of providers that are available to you when the end user uses a device. We have the People Hub, which has many different contacts from many different providers. So typically you would have your contacts from your Outlook database, or perhaps it's your Exchange server. Perhaps you use Hotmail or Gmail. All of that contact information gets pulled down. Maybe you have a Facebook account or LinkedIn account or Twitter account. All of that information is pulled down into the People Hub from the end. How many people here don't use Windows Phone? Okay, so for those of you that don't use Windows Phone, this is something that may be new. What we do is we aggregate all that information together into the contacts database. And so when you're accessing the contacts, you can tell where a contact is coming from. And also, depending on where a contact is coming from, there's different limitations that we have around what, based on the license we have from, like, Facebook, for instance, whether we can provide you some information. We'll talk about that in a few minutes. Actually, let's talk about it right now. So here are some of the various data providers. Some of them you have full information. So, for instance, Windows Phone device, that means the end user has actually entered the contact information directly on the device. They've actually tapped out the user's name or copied it from somewhere directly into their contact database. That's their information, so they can share it with you, and so we allow you to get access to it. Similarly, the Windows Live information, we know how that works. That's a Microsoft property, so you have full access to it. Exchange account, again, that's user information. They have all the rights to give you those rights, so we provide that. The mobile operator address book, there is no calendar related to that, so you won't get calendar. Facebook is probably the one that people get hung up on. According to the rights of what Facebook allows us to do with that contact information, they allow us to pull information down, but the only information that we can give you access to is the user's name and their picture, so that you can use it for social reasons. So you wouldn't get access to things like phone numbers and email addresses and all of that stuff from Facebook. Even though you can use it on the device, you can't use it in third-party apps. Does that make sense? And then there's other providers, Twitter and LinkedIn and all of those other social networks, if we add others later. Right now, you do not have access to those at all in the contact database. Does that make sense? Yes? Good question. The question was, is this read-only? And yes, this is read-only. There is a way to add contact information into the contacts database, and we'll talk about that in a few minutes using a chooser. So how do you read contacts? It's pretty straightforward. You would new up a contacts object and then send off a search request. Sorry, then you would hook up an event handler that would handle any search requests, and then you would fire the search request, and then the event handler would grab that information. It's pretty standard. It's kind of the way we do a lot of different things. In this case, this is not a filtered request. We'll talk about how you would filter in a couple of seconds. So this is just going to pull down all of the contacts in the phone on the device, and then you would see that in the search. Here is the search complete. And in many cases, if you're going to display it, you would just bind it to a control that is on another page, for instance, or on the page that you're currently on. This is the data binding. Pretty straightforward. In this case, it's a list box, and there's a data template that does the data binding. If you've done any data binding in the past, it's pretty straightforward. There's really not a whole lot of work that you need to do. So I mentioned about data providers. This is how you would find what the data providers are that are available in the current device. And so in this case, you're just looking at the account information. That's what it's called, account. And then in this case, it's just scanning through, iterating through the contact accounts, and then displaying the contact and the account name. So let's actually see how this would work. Just pop into Visual Studio. So let's actually run it, and then we'll come back and have a look at what it's doing. This is kind of big. Just make it a little smaller. And so I'm just going to hit the load button, and a couple of things happen there. So that load button fired a search. I guess you can't read that, so let me try and make that bigger. That better? Can you read that in the back, okay? Oh, you have screens in the back, right? Okay. So in this case, hit the load button. That fired off a request. The request then came back, and my event handler handled that, and bound it to the screen, just like we saw in the slides a couple of seconds ago. And so if we look at that, that should be in my mainpage.xaml.cs. And there's nothing fancy here. It just puts the word loading on the screen, news up a new contacts object, sets the data context for the accounts. This is the list of data providers. And then sets up an event handler for when the search is complete, and then fires off the search and gives the search the name contacts load. And then when the search comes back, here it is, it does two things. One is it binds the contacts result so that we can see the contacts, and then it just says if there was more than zero contacts, it's loaded. Now, one of the things you may have noticed, I didn't mention this, is that I'm running this on the emulator, and there is no people hub on the emulator, so there's no way to enter contacts. So we've actually done that for you. So when I run that application, those contacts came directly with the emulator. So anytime you load up the emulator, you have these, I think there's seven of them up there, that you can use for your testing. This is not the same thing with the calendar. With the calendar, there is no calendar entries, unfortunately. So for calendar, you'll have to do your testing on the device. Excuse me. Sorry. All right. Can you hear me again? Okay, great. So let's keep going. Are there any questions? I should say they told me that the Dutch are not shy about asking questions, but let me make it explicit. If you do have questions, please raise your hand and stop me. It's easier if we do it when you have the question in mind. So you can also filter anytime you do a search. So earlier we were doing a search without a filter, and that means you get all the contacts. In this case, I'm doing a, you'll see the filter kind there, shows display name. So that means I'm filtering on the display name. And using RO, and so that's going to show me all of the contact names that begin with RO. And there happens to be one in the database. And so it's pretty straightforward. There's a number of different filters that you can use. You can use display name. You can use pin to start screen, which would be one way of seeing all of the contacts that are important, maybe as a sort of a favorites of the user. You can filter on email address and phone number. So that's one. It's an easy way for you to find what the user, what you need to find for the user. If you need to do filters that are a little bit more complicated or are outside of the bounds of those four, you can do it with a link query. You have to be careful with those though, because they're not optimized or can sometimes not be optimized, which means that they might be slow, especially if the end user. Like myself, I think I have over 2,000 contacts on my phone. If you run a link query on 2,000 contacts on the device, it might be slow. So keep that in mind and do your testing with large data sets to make sure that you don't get low ratings from end users with large contact databases. So we saw contacts. Appointments are pretty much the same way. There's a similar set of properties and events and methods and so on that'll allow you to do that. And there's a search method as well and callbacks. It's very much like the contacts database, except obviously you're accessing the calendar. And I already mentioned there are no appointments in the emulator, so you have to do the testing, unfortunately, on the device. So someone asked earlier, contacts database was read-only. That's true, but you can create contacts. The first thing that you should note anytime you try to create a contact is that you cannot create a contact without the end user explicitly allowing you to do that. So you can't just say, here's 20 contacts, add them to the contacts database, and the user not know that. Every time you add a contact, the end user has to actually explicitly hit the save button. And that's the way you do that is with the chooser. You load up the contact. The end user sees what he's about to save. He hits the save button, and then you come back. And you would have to do that for each individual one. So it's done asynchronously so that it's outside the bounds of your application, and you come back. So choosers work that way. So there's differences between a chooser and a launcher, right? We talk about these kind of synonymously. They are sort of similar, but there are some very explicit differences. A chooser is something that you would use to allow the end user sometimes to choose something, or sometimes use it to save something, but always the chooser does a task for you and then comes back to your application automatically. A launcher is a little different in that it performs the task but doesn't come back. There's no explicit return to your application. So for instance, when you launch the web browser from your application, it's up to the end user to know that they got to hit the back button to come back, and you don't get any sort of notification of what the end user did in that launcher. All you know is that they've come back. So in either case, whenever you use a chooser or a launcher, your application will be pushed into the background, will become dormant, and may get tombstoned. Have they done a session on tombstoning and fast application switching? No. Well, it is an important topic. Anytime you build an application on Windows Phone, one of the things that you absolutely have to do is make sure that your application behaves properly when it gets pushed into the background, when it becomes dormant, so that when it comes back, you return back to the end user in a state that allows you to continue working and allows the end user to continue exactly where they left off. Okay, so creating a chooser, kind of similar to what we saw earlier. You new up a chooser. In this case, we're newing up a save contact task. And then we hook up an event handler that tells us when the end user is finished with the chooser. And then we have, in this case, the show method. I don't know if you can see that here, right down here. So in this case, we're adding the first name and last name to a contact, and then we're showing the end user that chooser, and then the end user has the ability to manipulate. Keep in mind that when you launch the chooser, the end user also has the ability to make changes. And so if, in this case, I want to add Ben Riga to my contacts database, I launch the chooser, the end user could decide, no, we're going to call him something else. We're going to change it to Sam Riga. If it's important in your scenario that you know what is added to the contact database, that means you have to go back and read it to make sure that what got added is what you expected, right? So it's a bit of a gotcha. In most cases, you don't care. It's the end user's database, but keep in mind that they can make changes. There's no way to have a read-only chooser pop up where the end user can save. They always have the ability to make changes. When the chooser completes, as I said, it is a... Oh, sorry. Go ahead. Yeah, you can fill in a full contact, everything you need, and then they get to click save. Sorry, so let me repeat for the recording. The question was, can I add additional information to the contact, email address and all that stuff? And yes, of course, you can fill in lots of good information, and then when it pops up, the end user has the ability to see it, edit it, and save it. When the chooser comes back, you get, in the previous screen, you saw we had hooked up an event handler. This is the event handler that comes back. It basically gives you an indication of what happened. Did the end user save it? Did they cancel out? Or did they try and save and the save didn't work for whatever reason? Disk full or what have you, no more room, that sort of thing. So you have to handle that in your logic. Make sure that you know what comes back and that you handle it appropriately. I mentioned this earlier. Whenever a chooser runs, you launch a separate application. Your application gets pushed into the background, and that chooser then has control. Your application is then dormant and could possibly become tombstoned if the end user goes off. You know, maybe they get a phone call or a text, and they go off to another application. Then they play a game, and then they, eventually your application gets pushed so far back in the stack that it's become tombstoned. And then they may decide to come back for whatever reason. So you have to handle all of that. It is appropriate it is important that you handle the appropriate way of handling fast app switching. And keep in mind that the user may never come back, right? They may forget about it completely. They may turn off their phone. So if it's important that they come back, then you have to handle that in your logic for the next time they launch your application. So let's actually play with a chooser. Any questions on that? Yep. Appointments, there is no chooser to handle creating of appointments. Yeah. Sorry about that. Yeah, let's make a contact here. Let me launch. Okay, so similar type thing. We're going to load the contacts. It's a very similar application. Let's run it, and then we'll come back and see what's going on. So if I load contacts, just like I did it earlier, I'm loading all the contacts from the database, and then I'm going to... by the way, for those that don't know, when you want to use the keyboard on your laptop or your desktop, if you hit the page up button, it dismisses the SIP, and then you can use your physical keyboard. Did everyone know that? You guys didn't know that? So you've been using the mouse on the SIP, is that right? Okay. I shouldn't have told you. It just made you suffer, right? Yeah, so that's a good tip. Write that one down. okay, so when I type Ben, whoops, I'm in caps lock. Oh. Okay. Apparently, I'm doing something wrong. There we go. Not sure what happened there. And now if I click the Make Contact, it launches the chooser. And you can see here, okay, you can't see it, but I can see it. Right under name, it's in red, so the contrast is not very good on the screen. But you can see Ben Riga in the name. And then if I had phone information or email or other sorts of things, I could add that. So if I want to change that, I would click on name, and now I can change that to whatever I want. Maybe I could add Microsoft and save that. I could add photo, a ringtone, any other sort of information that I might want to add can be done there. And then at some point, I'm going to hit save. And when I do that, it's going to save to the contact database. And now it's actually come back to my application. This code that's running here is just a message dialog that's actually in my application. And you can see the resuming. Okay, you can't see the resuming, but behind the scenes there's a resuming with some dots, which is typical of a Windows Phone application when it's coming back. If it takes more than a second or so, it pops up that resuming so the end user knows. Any questions on that? Let's actually look at what's going on behind the scenes. So here's that load button. It's identical to what we saw just a minute ago, so I'm not going to spend any time there. Here's the make contact, right? So save contact, I'm newing up a task, loading it up with some information, hooking up my handler, and then doing show. And then when it comes back, I'm just showing a message box that says saved OK. It's really, really easy to do. Any questions? Okay, so am I doing really well, or are you guys bored? Nobody's asleep yet, right? It's just too easy. There are other save tasks, save email address task, where you can save contact based on their email address. So, for instance, maybe you got an email from someone and you want to save it to the contact. You can actually save it as a new user or add it to an existing user. Same thing with a phone number. And also, if maybe your application has sound or songs, that sort of thing, you can actually allow the end user to save a sound as a ringtone. And then it would be available to them to add as a ringtone for their standard phone. And someone asked about this earlier, but let me say it again explicitly. There is no chooser to save an appointment to the calendar database. So this is a little bit more of a complete list of all of the choosers. If you go to MSDN, you'll see all of the choosers up there. So some of them are for choosing phone numbers, addresses, and email addresses. So for instance, if you need to get send an email or whatever, you can ask the end user to choose an email address from their contact database. A photo chooser, we'll see that one in a couple of minutes. Camera capture, sorry, not a photo. Photo chooser is choosing an existing photo already on the device. A camera capture is similar to that, except you're allowing the end user to actually take a photo. There is a game invite task. I get asked about this one sometimes. It's in MSDN, but it's only available if you're one of the few companies that has Xbox Live rights. There's only a few companies that can do that. And then saving email and saving phone number, and we talked about the ringtone task already. There are some launcher tasks as well. And as I mentioned, they work very similar to choosers, except that they don't explicitly come back and they really don't tell you what the end user was doing. Some of them are, well, I mentioned the web browser task, marketplace search or marketplace hub task. And then there's also some things. One that I think every application should use is the marketplace review task. The only way you get reviews to your application is if the end user actually goes to the marketplace, finds your application, and reviews it, right? So after they've installed it, you want them to do that because the more reviews you have, the higher up you go in the rankings and so on. So you want to encourage end users to do that. So right from within your application, you can actually put an option there that says, hey, click here to review my my application. And you would do that using the marketplace review task where it would launch the marketplace app, launch your application, and put the end user right in the review screen where they could then fill in, hopefully put 5 stars and tell the world why they think your app is the best. Yes?
Is there a way to determine if the user already did a review on your application?
So the question was, is there a way to check whether an end user has reviewed your application? And there is not. That would be a great thing, because then you could nag the end user every time they launch your app and say, you have to review now. But there isn't. There isn't. Yeah, I should mention one of the best practices that I've seen is applications that launch and they wait maybe 10 days before they do this, and then they'll launch a screen that says, hey, you've been using my app for 10 days now. Would you mind reviewing it, telling me what you think? And then they would take you to the marketplace review. So there's ways of doing it passively where you just put it in a button or on a menu, and there's ways of doing it a little bit more aggressively. You have to be careful. You don't want to annoy the end user. But yeah, so there you go. Any questions on launchers?
Yeah, I've got a question. Yeah,
sure. So that was a long question. Let me repeat it for the recording and for those at the back. It's pretty simple. I think what you're asking is why aren't you a lot better at handling OAuth? To reduce that to just a couple of words, and you're right. Well, first of all, the web browser task is just launching the web browser. There's also a web browser control, which you could embed in your application, where you would be handling, which you would probably use if you were doing OAuth type activities. It's not optimal. We could do better at that. And I'm not ready to talk about anything that's coming later. We've only just recently, within the past 6 months, launched Mango or Windows Phone 7.5. So it's a little early to talk about what's next. But yeah, stay tuned. So consider it a feature request. We'll do that. The right place to do that, though, we actually have a user voice forum where developers, there's two of them. There's one for consumers and there's one for developers. And if you have specific requests, you would go and you would get, I think you get 10 votes for the type of requests, the type of requests that you want. And so you probably would want to put all of your 10 votes on the OAuth capability. But it is one I hear fairly regularly. So, yes, it's not as easy as it could or should be. Any other questions? I thought I saw a hand go up. No? No. Okay. Right. So let's talk about using the camera. And there's a number of ways to use the camera. In Windows Phone 7.0, there really was only one way. You could basically use a chooser. And the chooser would launch the camera, allow you to take a picture, and then come back. And you can still do that. And I'll show you how to do that in a minute or so. Now there's a different way, which is you can actually basically just grab access to what's going on in the camera stream. And that enables some additional interesting scenarios. For instance, if you want to do a barcode scanner, you don't want people to take a photo of a barcode, come back and scan it, see if it was clear enough. If it's not clear enough, you can go back. So typically that's something where you want to scan and check over and over again until the end user gets it right. Or augmented reality is another typical one where you want the end user to sort of pan around, and as they're panning around, you want to show them interesting points of interest in the area, that sort of thing. So those are the types of scenarios that are available to you now. Well, let's start by looking at how you capture a photo using a chooser. And again, it's very similar to what we did with the saving a contact. You new up a camera capture task. You hook up an event handler for when it's done, when the end user has completed and has come back. And then you use the show method to do that. I should note that the emulator doesn't have a camera. Obviously, it's a virtual machine running on your box, and so it doesn't have access to your camera. And so we do some fancy stuff in the background to show you, and it basically just shows you a white block with some stuff. We'll see how that works in a couple of seconds. Just the same way the save contact task comes back, you want to make sure when you come back from a camera capture task that you verify what happened. Did they save the task? Did they not? And then once you know that you have a valid chosen photo that the end user has actually accepted, then you would do something with it. In this case, we have an image control on the screen, and we're going to set the image control source to a nude-up bitmap image that we've built from the URI of the file name that has come back from the camera. Okay, let's actually do this. And actually, at this point, since the emulator is just really so bad at taking pictures, I am going to use maybe not. Okay, probably not. Okay, let's just double check that I don't have too many of them. So we actually have available, this is available really only to Microsoft employees for a number of reasons. Let me just reset my phone. It only works on one device, which is the device I have here. It's a prototype that we use internally. It's an engineering device. It only works on test builds. So it would not work on a retail device with a retail build, unfortunately. And basically what it does is it allows me, rather than actually take a picture of the phone, I'm actually hooking up my phone using USB to my PC, and then I can see what's going on normally when it works. And it normally does. There we go. Now you all know my password. I actually have loaded first app on here already. So this is the chooser task, right? And so when I get rid of that, when I click the take photo, it's actually launching the camera task as if the end user had hit the camera button. And so now, everybody smile. Okay. And so now I've taken that, and if I accept that, I now have come back to my app, and now I have my photo that I've put on screen. Make sense? And now let's have a look at that code. Okay. It's all in those five lines of code, right? It's really, really easy. You can't get any easier than this, right? You new up the camera task, you show it, and then when it comes back, you do whatever you want with that image. Any questions there? It's pretty straightforward. This is how you did it with Windows Phone 7.0. It hasn't changed at all in Windows 7.5 when you use the chooser. So the question now is, well, what happens when you use in-application capture? And this is basically where you are grabbing access to the videos, to the camera stream, what's going on that sensor. And there you can do pretty much anything you want, including having access to the camera control and flash and all of that good stuff. This is how you would do it. You would new up a photo camera and then do something with that. In this case, we're using a viewfinder, a brush, a video brush on the screen to display what's going on. And then I'm setting the source to that, to my photo camera object that I just created. And then I'm also allowing camera capture available. So in other words, whenever the end user accepts a camera image, when I tell the camera image that I want to take an image, it will then feed me back whatever that image is that the end user that happened to be on the video stream at that particular point. Does that make sense? It's actually easier to do than to actually describe it. This is the viewfinder brush, the video brush that we were showing. And this is basically where you're building a viewfinder for the end user so they can see what is on that stream. And here's the camera capture image, right? So in the camera capture task, you actually have the end user is using the photo button, right? You can't do that on yours because you're actually taking full control of what the end user is doing. So you have to do it in some other way. In this case, we're actually going to use a button where the end user clicks the button. And when they click the button, that's when you capture the photo. And this is all you need to do that, right? It's camera.capture, capture image. And then as soon as you do that, when the capture image is complete, it comes back and gives that to you. And then here is the camera capture. This is when it's complete. And in this case, we're doing similar type things. We're saving it, in this case, to the media library, I believe. Where is it? Yeah, the media library. So we're defining a name for the image, right? Just making it up based on the current date and then adding .jpg on the end. And then newing up a media library, which is part of the, that's why we have the XNA framework.media up there. We're newing up a media library, and then we're saying library.save that picture to my media library. And so then it will just show up in my camera roll as just a standard photo that I may have taken for whatever reason, which means that it would then automatically, when I dock my my device to my laptop or whatever, Zune will launch and pull it off my device. It just becomes just like another picture that the end user happens to have taken. The other thing you can do is actually just display the image, which is very similar to what we did earlier, right? Similar idea where we basically grab the image that has come back and connect it up, in this case, to an image control. Nothing fancy there. And the other thing you might want to do is you might want to save it, but not to the media library. For whatever reason, maybe it's part of, you want to save it to a local isolated storage. And so again, it's pretty much the same way you give yourself access to the isolated storage file stream and then grab that writable bitmap and save it as a JPEG to the isolated storage. Any questions around this? You can do any of these. You can do a couple of these. You can do all of these. You don't have to do just one at a time. You can. It's just code, right? Yes?
What about video? You just told me about pictures.
So the question was, what about video? We'll see video in a few minutes. We'll do first just stills, and then you can do similar things with video. So let's actually come back and look at, hopefully this is working still. Okay, and so now we're doing similar type capability, except in this case, it's, right, can you see that? There's a bit of a lag, but it's pretty close, right? There's the latency is not that bad. And if I click the take picture, which I'll do right now, It takes a second. It's going to process it. And in this case, it's saving it. It saves it to the media library, saved it to isolated storage, and it's displaying it in that thing. So let's actually see what happened there. And it's pretty much as you would expect. So on Navigated 2, so as soon as my page opened up, I did some things. I created a new photo camera, which is what gives me access to that video stream. And I set the video brush on my page to be whatever is coming off the camera. And then I told it, as soon as I'm ready to, as soon as the end user has captured an image, here's what to do with it. And there's my thing, which I said earlier was, you know, saving it to the media library, loading it into an image, showing it on the screen, and then also saving it to isolated storage. Any questions on that? Is this making sense? Is this interesting? Yes? No? Maybe? Pardon me. So you can do, you can capture the image, and the image is just an image, right? So you can do all sorts of things with the image after the fact. So for instance, before I saved it, I could do some fancy processing on the image, which is interesting. But you can also work on the image as it's coming off the frames. And so that's what we're going to do in the next example. I'm using an example that was written by one of the MVPs, Rob Miles. Maybe you've heard of him. And basically what we're going to do is we're going to play with the details of what's going on the screen and just play with the colors so that we're going to, rather than have the full color image, we're going to change it so that we're going to modify every pixel on the image every time we get it, and we're going to change the pixels so that we just see primary colors. Make sense? So there's some fancy math here. I'm not a graphic artist, but you'll see what's going on there. This is how we would do that. We're defining a writable bitmap and setting the destination for our processed image. And then we're setting, so before we were saying camera capture, whenever the camera capture comes back, here's what I want you to do. Now we're doing something a little different. We're saying when the camera starts, whenever it's initialized, I want you to give me control. And so that means we can hook in earlier on and do some interesting stuff. And so that's what we're doing here is the event handler. As soon as my camera is initialized, I want you to tell me. And here's what we're going to do in this case. We're defining, we're grabbing access to the actual frames that are coming off the camera. We're newing up a new thread, and that thread gets started, and that thread in the background is what's going to actually do the processing of the image so that we don't lock up the UI thread doing processing. It's going on a separate thread. And here is where it actually grabs the image. So remember, we had that function called funky color, right? So we're going to call that funky color based on what's coming off the preview buffer, right? So you can see here that the camera is getting a preview buffer. We're going to get that, and then we're going to iterate through every single pixel one at a time and change the color on every pixel so that we can actually do something interesting. And then drawing that onto the screen. Let's actually see what that means. Okay. And so before, remember before we had to click the button to capture the image. In this case, you can see the latency there. There's just a minor lag. And as I pan around, every single one of the frames coming off the screen is being, you know, every single pixel on every single frame is being modified to show that. Make sense? And so basically, that's interesting, but the reason we're doing that is just to show that you have pretty much access to anything you want. And so this is where, if you were doing a barcode scanner, for instance, every time you would be looking at that and analyzing the image coming in to see, oh, is there a barcode here? Is there a barcode here? Is there a barcode here? And then when you found one, then you would beep and say, okay, I got whatever product you're trying to scan. Or if it was augmented reality, on every frame, you would be checking the position of the compass and seeing where direction you're pointing in, and maybe you would be pointing, going to a database and saying, oh, if you're pointing to the north, then you're looking at whatever. Make sense? So this is the code. I think we've already seen most of it already. Where am I here? So that's the pump frames. Where is it? Here. Here's the unnavigated to. So as soon as my page loads, I'm newing up the camera, and I'm newing up a writable bitmap. This is the one that's the one on the right where my processed image will go. This is when the camera gets initialized, and then I'm setting the viewfinder so I can actually see what's coming from the camera. And then when the camera gets initialized, this is where we are setting up my thread, and then that is way up here somewhere. Here it is. There's my function that's actually handling every single one of those frames. And here's where it's capturing, waiting. Here's capturing the preview buffer, processing every single one of the pixels, and then writing those back to the screen. And then if there's an error, there's an error, right? And there's that color to gray. We could that was one way of doing it. In this case, we're actually using funky color. Straightforward. Do you think you could do this? How many people are already thinking of doing augmented reality or that sort of thing? Barcode scanner? You're doing this already? But you want to. Okay, good. At least one. Okay. How am I doing on time? Still got 30 minutes, so I think we're good. Using the microphone, we're not going to spend a lot of time on this, but you do have full access to the microphone. It's part of the XNA framework. It works really well. It is possible to record sound, process audio, store it on your isolated storage. You can and then replay it later, send it to a service to get processed, whatever it is. There's a really good example on MSDN. If you want to do that, you can have that link there. I think all of the slides will be made available, so you can grab that directly off my slides. The other thing that's really handy on the devices are the sensors. In Windows Phone 7.0, you basically had only one sensor, the accelerometer. In fact, most of the devices actually also had a compass sensor as well, but there was no driver available and there was no API available for you to get to that compass. So the only thing you had access to in Windows Phone 7.0 was the accelerometer. In Mango, we've done a few things. One is that we've given you access to the compass. If your device has a compass, you should have access to it. And we also have added the gyroscope as a capability that you can use, which is usually much smoother when you're using it as opposed to the accelerometer, which is a little bit more blocky. The gyroscope, as I said, is brand new. It's only available on Mango devices. And they basically all work the same way. You basically hook into them, tell it how often you want to know what's going on when changes are made, and then it will fire an event every time that that reading changes. In order to get access to it, you need to use the Microsoft.devices.sensors library. That does not get added to your project automatically. You have to go and explicitly add the reference to that so that you can use it. And then it works. And then before you use it, you need to make sure that it's supported. So you need to make sure that the device your application is running on actually has that device and that device is ready ready to be used. And so all of the sensors explicitly support or have exposed an is supported method, and you can use that, and you should use that. The motion sensor is, I guess, what you might call a virtual sensor. It's not really anything new, but what it does is it makes using the accelerometer, the compass, and the gyroscope a lot easier. Basically, it combines all of those together into one virtual sensor, and it does all of the hard work for you. When you're using the accelerometer or the compass or the gyroscope, there's all sorts of crazy, fancy, big brain type math that you have to do in order to figure out where the device is in three-dimensional space and where it's pointing and all of that good stuff. The motion sensor just makes that really, really easy to do. It does all of the work for you, including trying to figure out which sensors are actually available in the device. So, for instance, if all you have, you need at least the accelerometer and the compass. Every device has an accelerometer. So if the device has an accelerometer and a compass, then the motion sensor is a lot easier to use than actually trying to do it by hand. And it provides all of the various things that you would expect: the attitude, pitch, yaw, roll, rotational rate, and direction of gravity. So using all of those things, you can pretty much figure out where you are in three-dimensional space. And it will use, like I said, whatever sensors are available. It has to have at least a working compass, but hopefully most devices, especially the higher-end devices, they all have gyroscopes as well. And it, like I said, it just makes writing augmented reality-type apps really super easy. It works pretty much as if it was a real sensor. You new it up. You tell it how often you want to know when the updates, when a sensor reading has changed. In this case, we're telling it every 20 milliseconds. That's how often I want to know. And then when the value has changed, you tell it, here's my event handler. When it's changed, let me know, and I'm ready to process it in this area. And then you would start it. Right? Once you start it, you check for an exception to make sure that it actually did start. And then once it started, it's running and doing all of that good stuff. And when you're no longer using it, you should remember to stop it because it's still going to be running even if you're not using it. And then here's an example of what you might do when it comes back. In this case, I'm just changing some text on the screen, a text control on the screen, to show what direction of the yaw pitch and what the yaw pitch and roll are. Someone asked about video content earlier. There's a number of different ways to display video content. You have the media element. Every Silverlight application can have one media element running. And in this case, this sample is just pulling a video file that's local on the disk and just playing it. Oh, by the way, there's a list of supported codecs. If I get that question quite often. You can actually pull that list directly off MSDN. That same media element can also display the source from a stream. And so if what you want to do is display a video file that's out on the cloud somewhere, it would just display it. And in this case, I've also got autoplay equals true, which means as soon as I load, it will actually start playing the video immediately. If you don't do that, then you have to explicitly say dot play or allow the end user to do that under program control, which you can do. And this is where you would do it. So for instance, if I wanted to pause the video, I have a pause button on the screen. I hit the pause button, media playback dot pause, and it gets paused. We also support smooth streaming. And so smooth streaming is really handy on a device because you never know what kind of bandwidth that device might have, whether they're on 3G or Wi-Fi or what have you. And so what smooth streaming does is it actually adaptively, in an adaptive way, goes up or down in quality based on how much bandwidth you have. And so we have some server-side code that we have available, and we also have some client-side code that we have available that handles that. And you can pull all of that down directly. The viewing software is there, and then you would also be using the media server on the server side as well. And you have to encode it properly, clearly, as well. Anybody doing smooth streaming today? No? Okay. So I am actually finished much earlier than I thought I was going to be finished, so I'm going to pause here for any particular questions you might have. Yes? So the question was, there's an easy way in the phone to actually post a message to Facebook. Is there a chooser to do that? And there is not. There is not. No. Yes. That's a good question. So the question was, are the sensors available on the emulator? And so here is the emulator, right? And if you look on the right of the emulator, there's a couple of things that you have access to. One of, if I bring that up, these are what are called additional tools. And here is the accelerometer. You can see I can actually change the direction in 3D space of the device. That is only for the accelerometer. There is no compass in the emulator, and there's no gyroscope. So only for the accelerometer. If you need to test for those, you have to use a physical device, right? And the other one, as long as I'm here in the emulator, for those of you who don't know, there's also a GPS simulator. And so here I can explicitly tell the simulator where I am in the world, right? And so I could tell it that I am close by anyway. Anyway, you get the idea. So I can put push pins. It's really handy. Sorry, was there a question?
No, we were wondering if you knew where you are.
Well, let's see. Today's Friday, so it is Netherlands. Am I close? Yeah, sometimes I wake up in the hotel and I have no idea what country I'm in. any other questions? The flash, yes. Yes. There is, okay, so the question was, how do I use the flash when I'm on the emulator? There is no flash in the emulator because there is no camera in the emulator. The emulator, let me just show you what the camera looks like on the emulator. Let's see, where is it? Here, auto camera is a good example. Let me just run this. And so here is, I think this is in widescreen, right? So here is what the emulator is using. Whenever it's emulating the camera, this is the image that you're going to get back. It's not really an image. It's just sort of a faked out something is going on type thing. It's very, very simple. And I can take a picture, but the picture that comes back is always the same one. It's just a blank picture that just shows you that you have an image. You can process it, do whatever you want with it, but it's not really an image of what's going on. And so if you're doing photo, this is really good to test your code, make sure it actually runs. But if you actually want to test what the code does, you're better off using the actual physical device. For the emulator?
Yep.
So the question was, well, what if I have a webcam on my PC? Couldn't my emulator just use that? And the answer is no. Unfortunately, it doesn't work that way. Yeah. Even if you have a webcam, you won't see the image off the webcam. Yes?
And how would you control the flash on your program?
Well, there is no flash. There is no flash on...
Ah,
yeah, so you have the options. So, for instance, when you do the camera capture, you can change the options of the camera. You have full access. Yeah, yeah. So when the end user clicks the camera capture button, you would turn on flash. Yeah. And that's how, for instance, there's some apps now that allow you to use the flash as a flashlight. That's what they're doing. They're actually using the photo camera and manipulating the photo camera without showing you on the screen what they're seeing. They're just using the photo camera to manipulate the flash. You have to be careful there, though, because it actually drains the battery very fast. Yeah, you don't want to leave that on overnight. Any other questions? Yes. Yes. So the question was, can I view I have a contact that I know. Can I launch a chooser maybe to view a contact rather than edit? Is that what you mean? From the People Hub, you mean the standard? Oh, okay, yeah, there is no. So the question was, the People Hub has this really nice view of a particular contact that includes their contact info, it includes their recent posts, includes access to their photos and all of that good stuff. Would there be a way for me to get to launch that view from my app? And unfortunately, at this point, there is not. There is not. It would be nice. It would be nice, yeah. Again, it's wpdev.uservoice.com. That's the right place to put those requests. Seriously, the program managers look at that all the time. When they're in planning mode, that's where they go first to see what people are having problems with, what people need. And then, of course, there's all sorts of other ideas, crazy ideas that those PMs have. But we listen very hard to what the community is asking for. I think I saw another hand go up. Yes. Ah, okay. Yeah, I knew I'd get questions on that. Someone else was asking about it earlier. Okay, so the question was, well, let me paraphrase. I could use my emulator, and when I use my emulator, I have access to my code so that I can debug and set breakpoints and all of that stuff. What happens when I plug my device, run my app on the device? How do I get access to all the debug info? And the answer is, it works virtually the same way. So when you're running on the device, I can't do it on this one because when I'm in USB out mode, I can't actually, that USB connection is being used to send the image from the screen. But it would work exactly as if it was in the emulator. You can set breakpoints. You can get access to your stack, everything. There's no limitation, even though you're on the device. It will use that USB cable to give you full access to essentially remote debugging.
I think that you have to just choose the device from the combo box.
Yeah, of course. Sorry, I assumed that because that's how you deploy, right? So let me stop here. So instead of going to the emulator or go to the device, I can't do it now because the device is not going to work. Did I leave it on? Yeah, so here's my device. Now you can't see what I'm doing, but if I click the play button, it's actually deploying. You can see in the bottom left, it's deploying, it's launching the UI task, and now I can see it. Everyone want to gather around, but trust me, I can see it, right? So I can actually view the viewfinder, and if I click the, I got to set a breakpoint somewhere. Okay, so if I now click the take a picture button, see how the breakpoint has been hit. It works virtually the same way as if the emulator was. It's the same. And I should say that the emulator, someone called it a simulator earlier. It's not a simulator. It really is an emulator. It's a virtual machine that's running the exact same code that the team puts on devices, right? So when we build for devices, now clearly there's drivers and so on for the devices that are specific to the device. But the emulator is actually running the same code as the devices. And the nice thing about that is that means that if you're running code in the emulator, there's a very high degree of compatibility between what's going on in the emulator and what's going on the devices. There are some changes, some differences because of drivers and all of that stuff, so you definitely need to test on physical devices. But you can do most of your work. I would say 95 to 99% of your work, depending on what you're doing, you can do on the emulator and be pretty close to done before you need to actually have a physical device. Not that I want to discourage you from buying a device. You should all buy three. Any other questions? All right. Well, I think we finished 11 minutes early. Thank you very much for your time. If you have any questions, I think I said it earlier, follow me on Twitter. Send me an email, follow me on Twitter, or the puppy gets it, right? If you don't want to do it for me, do it for the puppy. Okay, thank you very much.